Hello and welcome to the Ballot Box global election coverage from a team of political scientists. I'm Jonathan Parker in London.
I'm Chris Terry in Manchester.
I'm Andres Lesser in New York City.
Okay, hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Ballot Box. And so this week we're going to be talking about the general election which took place in Nicaragua on the 7th of November, which, as you probably have gathered from the news reports on this one, was not particularly competitive at all, but is still a kind of very interesting case of democratic backsliding again that we've talked about in previous weeks. So we'll dig into that in a minute. First of all, how is everyone? How's New York doing, Andres?
It's doing fine. We're enjoying the autumn weather. It's so beautiful in the autumn, New York.
And how about in Manchester, Chris?
Well, I haven't mentioned this on the podcast or in many places yet, but I've had a bout of COVID, so that hasn't been fun. But I'm out of isolation today. I'm feeling fine. I don't appear to have infected anyone else as far as I can tell, so everything's good and happy.
All good. Nice conclusion to that story.
Hopefully I'll be more resistant to COVID in the future.
Glad to know that you're doing all right.
Yes, I'm good. So yes, no one needs to worry about me.
And how about London, Johnny? How's everything going there?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I had something of a COVID scare this week as well, but it's turned out to be nothing. But yeah, generally it's all fine. Plugging out away now into the second half of the academic term, which means lots of marking at the moment. But other than that, it's all
yeah. Good. It is annoying because, like, according to the official figures, cases are now going down again in the UK. But Jonathan and I have both managed to have kind of various versions of scares. Just at that moment.
It's the poli-sci variant. It attacks people who know too much about electoral systems.
Yeah. Okay, all right. We'll turn to Nicaragua, which is, I think it's good that we're talking about a Latin American election again after so long away from the region. But obviously, it could be a happier story that we were commenting on for our kind of return.
Yeah.
So Nicaragua did hold elections to the presidency, to the unicameral legislature, the National Assembly, and also to the for Nicaragua's members of the Central American Parliament. But these were not competitive elections. Elections in Nicaragua have just been slowly getting less and less competitive, and there really, really wasn't any competition to this one at all. It was won again by Daniel Ortega, which has been his fourth consecutive election victory, consecutive term that he'll be serving now, his kind of fifth overall, because he was president 85 to 90 as well. Sort of repression of opposition candidates has been really clear to see in this election. Several of them were jailed, opposition parties were disbanded. So there wasn't a particularly democratic contest in any way. But as is our want, I think we'll run through the constitutional setup a bit first, with the caveat that obviously a lot of these kind of exist on paper to a certain extent at this point. But yeah, well, why don't we take us through the formal constitution of Nicaragua?
Sure. Yeah. So Nicaragua, like all Latin America, is a presidential system. Like most of Latin America, it's a mixed presidential proportional representation system. It's a unicameral, it has a unicameral parliament. The presidency is powerful on paper and obviously has become extremely powerful in practice, as Daniel Ortega has kind of soaked up even more power than what is already allotted to him and has broken down checks and balances. So it makes sense to talk about the presidency, which is elected every 5 years for a post. Presidents in Nicaragua used to be able to be reelected once, but there was reelected in consecutive terms once, although they could be reelected if there were gaps in between their terms. But there was a change in constitution in 2013 to allow for reelection. And this change in the constitution, well, it allows for continuous, consecutive, indefinite reelection. So basically, you know, you can rule forever if you win the election and you're still alive. And this change in the constitution is very much a part of the democratic erosion that Nicaragua has seen, and that this election in 2021 was kind of, you know, made extremely clear, right? So Article 147 of Nicaragua's constitution was modified in this year, 2013. And I think it's really, it's important to note that democratic erosions and the breaking down of checks and balances happens through a lot of different mechanisms, and they're oftentimes very clever. I think one shouldn't underestimate the intelligence and strategic kind of strategic vision of leaders who are trying to knock down checks and balances. So, for example, in this case, this constitutional change was presented to Parliament mixed in with another constitutional change, which made official the expansion of territorial sea for Nicaragua that was given to them through a ruling by the International Court of Justice that decided to favor Nicaragua in a case against Colombia and some islands that Colombia has off the coast of Nicaragua. So in this sense, those who voted against indefinite continuous re-election could then be framed by Ortega as being anti-patriotic and not voting in favor of the expansion of territorial sea. That's just one example of many of how, how strategically canny Ortega has been in lots of different cases, right? In the erosion. And this is obviously affected the constitution. Now the parliament, which is unicameral, has 92 members, and it's called officially the National Assembly. 20 members are elected from a countrywide constituency, and 70 are elected through multi-member constituencies from out through the country. And there's a quirk because there are two additional seats that were included there after the period of civil war, and allows for one seat to be reserved for the outgoing president of Nicaragua, so that the president also becomes a parliamentarian for at least one term without being elected. And another seat is reserved for the runner-up of the election, so number two in the presidential election. And it's an interesting kind of arrangement. It seems to be like some sort of incentive so that politicians don't become anti-systemic, or that they have a stake in the election even if they lose it. I thought that was smart. I'm sure that there are other systems that have similar interesting kind of arrangements. It's undemocratic in the sense that it doesn't rely on citizens' vote, and people don't get elected to that position, but it creates a form of kind of buy-in from other leaders. There are other features of the constitutional setup, but I think that these are the main ones. And I think it's particularly noteworthy that there's, indefinite re-election, and that these, it was an uncompetitive election. So the constitution was distorted in its spirit, as we'll talk about when opposition parties were disbanded, etc. So it's not very, the constitution isn't being really upheld.
Yeah, so we'll get on to this. I think the kind of backsliding that's happened in the last decade or so in a minute, it's probably, I'm going to try not to spend too long on elaborating a history of 20th century Nicaragua, but it probably is a good idea to just run through some of it quickly. Obviously, the Sandinista Revolution is probably one of the Nicaraguan events that people might be familiar with in kind of more generally. Before this, obviously, there wasn't a very democratic state of affairs in Nicaragua either. We had the Somoza family, which ruled for kind of four decades. Do you want to just briefly kind of overview what that rule was and how that they came to fall?
Sure. So the person, Daniel Ortega, who won re-election for the fourth time and will now have a fifth presidential term, comes from the Sandinistas. And the Sandinistas are this, armed force political movement that overthrew Somoza. And the Somoza family was this dictatorial family that ruled over Nicaragua with an iron fist, employed state terror to uphold a regime of landholders. They were propped up by the United States, especially during the Cold War, you know, just awful abuses of power and using Nicaragua as their kind of personal booty in many regards, right? So the Sandinistas were an armed force, popular movement. They had support from the intelligentsia as well. After the 1972 earthquake that destroyed parts of Managua, and where the Somoza family siphoned off a lot of the reconstruction funds, this was kind of like, I guess, the straw that broke the camel's back, and the Sandinistas win the revolution after a very prolonged battle, lots of different types of support, and an opening in the United States that kind of, you know, where Jimmy Carter favors the Sandinistas, is neutral about the Sandinistas and doesn't actively oppose them for a few years. This allows them to establish government. And a lot of people actually, like Peter Smith, would kind of say that 1979, the victory of the Sandinistas, is the beginning of Nicaragua's long transition to democracy, right? However, under the Reagan administration, the United States starts funding covert operation against this government. It becomes very, very unstable. There's a, you know, the civil war is prolonged. The way in which that's resolved is, in a sense, forcing the Sandinistas to hold elections under certain conditions. And Ortega wins in 1985. So that's the first time he won. And he wins as a very popular Sandinista candidate in this period of turmoil after the Sandinistas' military victory, when they established competitive elections. Then the economy crashes, and in 1999, Violeta Chamorro, who was the widow of a guy, of a famous journalist that was killed by Somoza, and she herself had opposed Somoza as a kind of liberal and not a socialist, and had originally supported the Sandinistas. She wins in 1999. Violeta Chamorro and Ortega it's interesting that they would have been competitors in 1999, because Violeta Chamorro's daughter is now the most prominent opposition politician in Nicaragua. She's been jailed, but there's a sense that history is rhyming in Nicaragua, not repeating, but rhyming. So, you know, just quickly, Violeta Chamorro, she comes from a kind of elite background, but she and her husband opposed the Somoza regime, unlike most landholders in Nicaragua, who were happy to kind of go along with the privileges that they were able to maintain under the Somoza regime. Violeta Chamorro's husband, who was a journalist, was murdered, and then she turned fully into kind of like, she backed the Sandinistas to begin with. As the economy crashed, she distanced herself. And her daughter, Cristiana Chamorro, kind of is still very prominent and works for the same newspaper that her family owns, and opposes the Ortega regime with all of the kind of historical, I think, reverberations of her mother's presidency. And from the 1990s, when Violeta Chamorro won, to the until 2006, the Sandinistas are out of power. And there are fairly competitive elections in Nicaragua, although it's obviously not a very robust democracy, partially because it's so young, because there's still echoes of instability. And in 2006, Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas win an election. You know, they win it legitimately, and Ortega is incredibly popular, actually. But once in power, this time around, in 2006, Ortega starts to act very differently than what his predecessors in power in Nicaragua had done. In what sense? Well, to begin with, Ortega starts a very aggressive campaign to expand his coalition. So he becomes extremely socially conservative, which marks a watershed point with the Sandinistas of the past. So, for instance, you know, he cozies up to the Catholic Church, which is very popular in Nicaragua, and he passes a law that restricts abortion completely in Nicaragua in 2007. So Nicaragua is one of the only countries in the world where abortion is completely forbidden under any circumstances, even when that mean when that is done therapeutically to save the woman's life. And you know, he gives other sorts of concessions to the Catholic Church, and gets the church on his side. And so he starts forming a coalition that looks unlike the traditional Sandinista coalition, which is mostly about redistribution and the peasantry and social justice and progressive politics, right? So Ortega starts already becoming very, very conservative socially, right? Then Ortega, in this period of time, starts giving a lot of concessions to the business community in Nicaragua. And so he passes very, very business-friendly legislation, especially for the export of agriculture, which is what most business people in Nicaragua, that's the strongest sector, especially, I think, coffee exports. He also passes huge tax breaks for large corporations. And then he gives the business community a permanent seat at the table through the Chamber of Commerce called COSEP, where Ortega will constantly consult this Chamber of Commerce before he passes economic policy. And so this also creates, this broadens his appeal and gets business leaders to support him. It's also worth noting that from 2006 to 2017, Nicaragua sees an annual growth rate that averaged 4%, which is extremely, you know, extremely high. So it's a period of economic bonanza that coincides with his amplifying his coalition or extending his coalition. And he also receives cash injections from Venezuela in the form of subsidized oil and other forms of cash assistance from Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. And Hugo Chavez's pretty aggressive move to, have influence outside of his country. At the same time that this is happening, that there's economic growth, that there's an expansion of Ortega's coalition, and that he's, I think legitimately quite popular, he's also attempting to break down checks and balances and concentrate power around not only his party and his person, but also his family, and using his family in a very distasteful way to extend his power. So, for example, we already talked about the 2013 constitutional amendment to extend to allow the president to be reelected indefinitely. But then, for example, he also changes Supreme Court justices and basically turns the Supreme Court of Nicaragua into, an extension of his power, totally erodes their autonomy. He does the same with the electoral management body. So the electoral management body will by 2021, favor Ortega massively, right? Ortega was reelected in 2016. And this time, he was reelected in 2011. I think he was still popular then, relatively speaking. And then in 2016, once the reform had passed, he was elected again. This time he obtained over 72% of the vote. But this is partially because the Supreme Court had moved to strip the main opposition candidate, Eduardo Montealegre, the control of the Independent Liberal Party, and said that he could not run as the presidential candidate. So already in 2016, Ortega had tested a strategy whereby officially autonomous institutions such as the Supreme Court or the Electoral Management Body would interfere to take down Ortega's rivals so that he would run with much less opposition. Another thing to note about Ortega's government is that as it's drifted towards authoritarianism, his family has become truly all powerful, and there's corruption that is pretty transparent as well, and their wealth has grown. So for instance, Rosario Murillo, who's Ortega's wife, is also the vice president of Nicaragua and has been for several terms. She's also the spokesperson of the government, and she is the head of the press office of the presidency, and is the person in charge, or her office is in charge of providing access to journalists into the country. So famously in 2021, Rosario Murillo, the wife of Ortega, denied all foreign correspondents a visa to enter Nicaragua to cover the 2021 elections. Right? Also famously, Rosario Murillo is she mixes her kind of beliefs, her esoteric beliefs, with her Christian or apparently Christian values, and her taste for socialism, and blends them all into one. One of her famous phrases or one of her famous rallying cries is a Christian socialist and a Christian socialist and solidarity full Nicaragua. Or she'll say something like, blessed be the land, socialist and free. And so she mixes, explicitly Catholic rhetoric with socialist rallying cries. She also was behind the erection of trees of life across Managua. There's these huge structures that imitate, they kind of look like trees. They cost a lot of money, and they filled the center of Managua in a kind of controversial urban redevelopment plan. And they're kind of a focus point of demonstrations against the regime, these trees of life, which she's personally kind of tried to make the city full of them, which I don't know, it's an oddity. And then another thing to note is that four of Ortega's children are the CEOs of major public channels across the country. So there was an aggressive buyout by friends and loyalists of the regime of different TV and radio channels, who would then appoint Ortega's children to head either the news section or the whole of the media. So Ortega controls the media through his children's management of media companies, right? That's also made them very rich, because they're basically in control of a lot of the publicity that happens, that businesses can hire across the country. So we can see there's a kind of very, in a way, very transparent uses of state power for personal gain and concentration of power.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you're saying about history rhyming, because it is almost they've taken the place of the Somoza family by this point. It's very sort of once overthrew. We get on to talking about the election itself this year, I wonder if you could briefly take us through obviously you had these two big opposition parties, the independent liberals and the constitutionalist liberals. Could you tell us I know obviously they're not playing huge roles in the elections anymore, but briefly tell us about them and the kind of division between them and the Sandinistas.
So it's my understanding that the constitutional that these two parties were quite old, and that the especially the Conservative Party comes even from is the heir of the 19th century civil war in Nicaragua. Like all Latin American countries had civil wars in the 19th century that were split between liberals and conservatives. And one of these parties, I think it's the Independent Liberal Party, is the heir of this very old 19th century party at some point.
The brief cursory research I did suggested that they were both fairly similar, just kind of center-right liberal parties, like kind of sort of more kind of classical liberal parties. Obviously they have declined quite significantly by not very democratic means in the last decade. Although the PLC did present a candidate this time, which didn't do very well.
What the Supreme Court did with the PLC, so there's like two things that the Supreme Court has done. One, or the electoral management body of the Supreme Court has done. One is to disband parties, and the other is to wrest control away from the traditional leader of the party. So in the case of PLC, the Supreme Court told the leader of the party that he could no longer be in charge of the party. So it's been given to people who support Ortega, but they present themselves as an opposition
party. Right. Okay. That's really interesting. I didn't realize that. That's absolutely fascinating, because that is obviously another tried and true tactic which especially I think about kind of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe, that they used to use these parties which previously had existed before the communist takeover would continue to exist in kind of shell form, but controlled by people who supportive of the regime.
That's right. Yeah, it sounds very much like what's done in Russia, right, as well. Presenting all alternatives.
No, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think it reminds me quite a bit of Russia, because I think when we were talking about that, we were saying, well, do we debate whether this is a competitive authoritarian regime or not? Obviously, there is more competition than there is in some authoritarian regimes, but the competition is not really there anymore because these parties, to one degree or another, are completely loyal to the regime now. So yeah, I think it's in that kind of similar zone if we were to kind of measure the authoritarianness and competitiveness of regimes. I think definitely.
Yeah. Sadly, yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Should we turn to 2021 now?
Yeah, I think we should just very briefly. I think we should note that in that this broad coalition that was supporting Ortega, church, a lot of the business people, and the traditional Sandinista base, although with a caveat, of course, a lot of prominent Sandinistas who fought during the civil war broke with Ortega early on and have been breaking with him. So even, you know, I think the moral leader of the Sandinistas at one point called Ernesto Cardenal, who is a poet and a Catholic priest, very prominent. Also, you know, he upholded he defended the guerrilla as well, the Sandinista armed movement. He broke with Ortega very early on, noting that he had betrayed the Sandinistas. And many Sandinistas who actually fought in the civil war have broken with Ortega. And have noted that he's embarked on a completely different project about like personal gain.
But do you have a sense of how Ortega is seen by the LATAM left outside Nicaragua? Because I, for example, I saw the Workers' Party of Brazil tweet congratulations to Ortega. And then that seemed to get a lot of pushback. I think the tweet was eventually deleted. Is there a kind of still a sense, because of, there's quite a lot of very old ties between LATAM left parties, that Ortega is still kind of one of us, or is that breaking down, or like?
No, I think it's very much breaking down. Like Ortega has the name Sandinistas behind him because he's occupying that party, and the Sandinistas were extremely important for Latin American left because they were, you couldn't avoid supporting them, right? There were these like very heroic, brave, mostly peasant and intellectual participants who were fighting against a horrid dictatorship that, you know, the Somoza family was. They used state terror in the most awful ways. It was hard, you know, everyone supported them. And when they won, they were one of the few guerrilla movements which actually won in Latin America, along with Cuba, like the revolution triumphed. So a lot of people from around the world went to Nicaragua in the early 80s to work with the Sandinistas, including a lot of Americans too. They were called the Internationalists. And so a lot of the Latin American left at some point was involved in Nicaragua or actually was in Nicaragua. So I think there's still some of that nostalgia left. And I think some people mistakenly, I don't know if, I think they'll, I think some parts of the left in Latin America will support anything that is counter-hegemonic. And by this, I mean anti-US, because the US has involved, you know, it's been involved in politics in very unsavory ways in the region, and especially in Central America.
Yes, so, and Nicaragua, especially infamous conflict in those terms. Like, I think if even people who don't really have much awareness of Nicaragua outside it, who are kind of interested in politics, have heard of the Sandinistas at least, and have a sense of like that was a big conflict of the Cold War in the 80s between kind of the left and right in Latin America.
Exactly, and that the U.S. was so disproportionate in its in its attack against the Sandinistas, who were legitimately popular, and they were being, you know, they were being, and the U.S. supported this horrible counterinsurgency, and engaged in massive human rights violations.
Yeah, and of course, infamously, the Sandinistas themselves in that period did engage in human rights violations as well, but that doesn't necessarily make it a simple struggle.
Exactly. However, with all this kind of context, a lot of the people on the left, Latin American leftists, can, you know, see through, or, you know, Daniel Ortega's posturing, and they've been very critical of the Ortega regime. And you can see this in, for example, the Organization of American States vote to condemn the election. Most, you know, majority of the OAS voted to condemn Ortega's re-election. There were 7 abstentions, and those abstentions largely correspond to where the left is in power. But so, for example, Mexico abstained in the OAS. Mm-hmm. There's an ostensible leftist in power, but the Mexican government has received a lot of blowback, even from within its own party, even from within like the current left-wing party, saying precisely, you know, Ortega is not a Sandinista. Yeah. Like he's not the leftist we want to support at all. So there's a division, and I think most people on the left are critical of Ortega now, but there's still this kind of institutional overhang. And I think actually one of the things that made him very unpopular and that has unmasked him, I think in the eyes of the left especially, is the enormous amount of repression that his government has exerted against its own citizens. And I think the 2018 protests, spearheaded by students, and then, you know, there were, and then the kind of erupted and became kind of very massive popular protests, but they were spearheaded by students who are generally kind of this progressive force in Latin American politics. And they were violently suppressed by state forces, by the police and the military. During these protests in 2018, the business community also split with Ortega, and the Catholic Church did as well. So this kind of broad coalition that he had created started to break down. This is partially because the economy started to slow down, and so he had fewer resources to keep lots of people happy. But it's also because he had, you know, the students started protesting because they were fed up with the, you know, blatant dictatorship that was going on. But the repression was so massive that official, or, you know, research suggests that up to 100,000 people fled Nicaragua, you know, fleeing violence and persecution by the, mm-hmm. by the police, and many people were killed. A lot of students were famously locked up unjustly. Right? So the 2021 elections, I think, have as the kind of the most immediate context, these 2018 protests and violent suppression. Then in the lead, and right between these protests and the election, the government, in parliament passed, you know, very restrictive laws, including 2 very infamous ones, the foreign agents law, which requires Nicaraguans receiving funds from abroad to register as foreign agents, and the special cyber crimes law, which criminalizes the dissemination of false or distorted information using communication technology, right? So they've gone a step further from what, you know, I think anyone's done. And so they've actually prohibited the diffusion of false news. But of course, the government's the one who decides what is fake news and what is not. It's so just awful, really dystopian.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, thank you for that anyway.
Yeah, no, of course. I've gone into start talking about the 2021 elections anyway, because it really follows from this I think from the repression in 2018.
Mm.
Prominent critics of the government have also been arrested. I think one of them, or have been, you know, they've been given home arrests, house arrests. They've been intimidated or they've fled the country. I think one of the most famous is Sergio Ramirez. He's Nicaragua's most prominent writer. He won the biggest prize in Spanish literature, the Premio Cervantes, which is kind of like the Spanish language, I guess, I don't know, Booker, maybe more than the Booker, because it's given for the whole career. But he was also the vice president of the Sandinista government under Ortega in 85 and 90. So he was also very close to the party. And he's been an outspoken critic of the regime. And he's basically said Ortega has become Somoza, right? Basically. So he was intimidated. He has an arrest warrant. His case was quite famous. In the lead up to the election, I think most famously or most importantly, seven presidential candidates, all seven, either got arrested or were put under house arrest for all sorts of different charges. Cristiana Chamorro, who's the most famous of them, the daughter of Violeta Chamorro, was put under house arrest under a case of tax fraud, right? And I'm always reminded of the fact that, who was it? Who was the famous mafioso in the US who got caught on tax fraud?
Oh, Al Capone.
Al Capone, right, thank you. Yes, Al Capone got caught on tax fraud, right? So they've used this, you know, that's the easiest thing to get someone on. So it's basically, you know, it's obviously very political, it's politically motivated, her arrest, along with the arrest of the other seven presidential candidates.
Mm.
Three opposition parties have been disbanded. So among them, the Party for the Recovery of Democracy that was headed by Cristiana Chamorro. And so what was left for the 2021 election are the so-called zancudos, or mosquito parties. And mosquitoes is a term that was coined by the Nicaraguan sociologist Oscar René Vargas, talking about the parties that would play this double game during the Somoza regime, where they would officially oppose Somoza, they'd be official opposition, but they actually played along with the regime's politics in order to obtain benefits from participating in elections. So it's kind of like Juan Linz's notion of the loyal opposition, but one that is kind of corrupted and plays along inauthentically. So in Linz's case, loyal opposition plays along with the system that's unfair, but does it in a kind of authentic way. The zancudos or the mosquitoes are just, you know, they're so called because they suck the blood of the people through the money that they get and the kind of benefits they get from playing along with the regime. So traditional opposition parties, such as the Constitutional Liberal Party, have been hollowed from the inside with the help of the Supreme Court and electoral authorities. And now, you know, this traditional opposition party, which had, you know, historically opposed the Sandinistas and opposed socialism, the socialist government, now votes with the Sandinistas in the National Assembly. And the candidate that they presented, Walter Espinosa, is also very much kind of a puppet to the regime. So there was a call for a boycott of the election, because everyone knew that it would be extremely uncompetitive. Ortega ended up receiving 75.9% of the vote, and the runner-up, Walter Espinosa, got 14.4% of the vote. Third place got 3.26% of the vote. But, you know, the election is so uncompetitive that, you know, the percentages mean very little. It means almost nothing. I think the real dispute, or the real kind of competition, then became whether or not people showed up to the polls, because Cristiana Chamorro and other opposition, like critics, Sergio Ramirez, etc., called for boycotting the election. Foreign correspondents were not allowed into Nicaragua to cover the elections, and neither were electoral observers, like independent electoral observers. So it's hard to get a sense of really how many people participated. According to the official Nicaraguan government sources, say that turnout reached 65%. But an independent organization called Urnas Abiertas calculated that in fact only between 21 and 16% of Nicaraguans voted. So probably only people mobilized already by the government actually went to the polls. Which is, it's striking. If it's true that only 20% of Nicaraguans voted, this signals, you know, that Ortega's actually in you know, very unpopular, because only 20% of people would actually want to go out and vote. And so it's also a signal that the way that he rules is not, you know, it's not earning him any popularity, and that he'll probably see more difficulties in the months to come, and in the years to come, opposition to his government. Yeah. I think one of the things that I would flip the script and ask you guys is, what do you think, like, the function of an election in these sort of authoritarian regimes have? Like, why do these, like, de facto dictators actually go through the motions of having elections?
Well, I think there's several reasons, and obviously I can't speak too much to the Nicaraguan case, but I think partially there is this idea that gives you some kind of sort of facade of democratic legitimacy, that people aren't looking too carefully. They might just accept the results and say, oh, they're holding elections, there was other candidates, they're just a popular figure, kind of thing. It might play in some regard. Also they do serve some functions, I think, it for regimes. I mean, it depends on how competitive they are in testing their kind of popularity. See, if they're doing it right, there's not a chance that they're going to lose, but if they vote goes down slightly, then they
even if you're falsifying turnout and so on, there's probably a chance that the government knows who's how many. You've got a sense of how many people are turning out to vote, even if you're in the process of falsifying it, and that can kind of provide an indicator as well.
Mm. I mean, especially if you're one of these regimes as well that's got lots of co-opted kind of allies and other parties, the elections serve a good role for kind of bringing them into the system and giving them seats around the table if you're still having elected legislatures and stuff like this as well. There's a variety of, and somebody more expert in semi-authoritarian regimes than me could probably give you a longer list, but yeah, it's one of the ones that occurred to me.
I'm not really an expert in semi-authoritarian regimes. It's not really something that I spend a huge amount of time reading into, but I think one thing that comes up as well is like the pantomime of holding an election under such regimes becomes kind of a way of justifying the regime itself. A very extreme example, under the Soviets, like there were elections held where you only had one candidate, like completely blatantly. And so Stalin's whole thing was like, we turned the whole thing into like a big ceremony. That even the counting of the votes, like having observed election counting in Ukraine, there's still this problem now where you have an entire room full of counters and like they just like very slowly one person takes out a ballot at a time, like puts it out of foot. So almost like a kind of ceremonial approach to election, it drives you insane if you're an election observer, like, because you're just can you please hurry this up, I've only got a certain number of days in the country. That kind of ceremonial aspect is kind of almost used to kind of justify the regime itself.
Yeah, I think you also have this aspect of like being able to say to the real opposition, well, look at the chances of you beating me are nothing. Look how many votes I'm getting, kind of thing. To some extent, that's known that a lot of them are fabricated. It's a kind of deterrent to hold these. So.
Yeah, and in this case as well, you kind of have an opportunity to kind of identify opposition leaders to a certain extent, and then deal with them in whatever way it is that you want to, because the moment they start putting themselves forward as candidates, the moment they've kind of officially declared themselves to some extent as the enemies of the regime. Then you can kind of go about putting them under house arrest for whatever trumped up charges or whatever it is you want to do.
Yeah, I'm always surprised at how difficult it is to completely like snuff out elections from political life once they're there. It's, they seem to serve a function for authoritarians for sure.
Even in hyper authoritarian regimes like North Korea, you still have an election of sorts. North Korean case, like it's almost like a state mandated census.
Exactly. And yeah, I was also reminded of Lisa Wedeen's book. I'm blanking on the name. Her very famous book on the Assad regime in Syria in the 90s in Syria, where the regime kind of it forces people to do these kind of seemingly ridiculous, kind of empty political rituals because they reinforce kind of, you know, the notion that there's no escaping this, like this, you have to do it.
The Assad regime was one of the ones I was thinking about in terms of like elections as ceremony. Because if you, it's like, for example, I remember seeing pictures of the in the aftermath of the last Syrian election, which I think was last year, where like huge like election day rallies and parades in the aftermath, like celebrating the victory of the regime in these completely fake elections.
Well, it's a sad, I mean, it's a sad thing to talk about. But it's I think it's also true that given the state of democracy in other countries in the world and in other regions, I don't think that Ortega is going to face that much international pushback. Like the White House sent a very, you know, they published a very stern sort of communication, you know, saying that Ortega was a dictator, blah, 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 blah. But that sort of like international kind of criticism, I think, is now very ineffective. The United States is planning on thinking about rolling back a free trade agreement with Nicaragua, and that could actually, that would have a huge effect on its economy. But we've seen, you know, its neighbor to the south, Venezuela, completely crumbled and destroyed economy. The regime was able to survive even amidst enormous, you know, poverty and squalor. That might just be, you know, a lot of human suffering for change.
Yeah, and there's an interesting aspect, I think, now with the relationship with the United States, in that Nicaragua isn't seen as a problem on an ideological level, because even though it's the Sandinistas, like they're not seen, like obviously the context of the Cold War is gone, but also I mean, as we've discussed, in many ways it's not a particularly ideologically leftist government, and like Nicaragua is more of a problem for the United States as in terms of its effect on US domestic politics, because for example it creates refugees that move on towards the US border. It creates crime, which intersects with the drugs war. In those terms as well, it's an interesting change in the relationship.
No, and you're absolutely right. And I think something that is worth mentioning, though, in the context, is that Nicaragua is actually, oddly enough, it's one of the safest countries in Central America, in the sense that it's one of the countries with the lowest homicide rate in Central America. Possibly, I think some of it, Deborah Yashar of Princeton had a book on the ecologies of homicidal ecologies, she called it. And her explanation is that Nicaragua's police forces were mostly combatants from the Civil War who were integrated into the police force as part of the kind of peace arrangement. And so they're very, you know, they're very legitimate, and they have like, they're actually trained soldiers. They're hard to corrupt. You're absolutely right. I think the United States is much more concerned about immigrants and refugees and kind of drug, you know, violence related to drug trafficking than it is with at the moment in Central America, than it is with, like, you know, expanding democracy or challenging regimes that don't even this sort of regime. But who knows, maybe Biden in his because Biden has, with along with Kamala Harris, have proposed this kind of very large plan to remedy the root causes of migration. And one of the axes of this plan is governance. So maybe under this plan, they will actually care about care more about the state of Nicaragua's
government. Yeah, although it's hard to say what they can really do, because, you know, it's not the 80s anymore. They're not going to support counter-revolutionaries or anything like that. For listeners who enjoy hearing about Latin America, this is essentially the first election of Latin America Month, where we have a series of Latin American elections. We've got Argentina, Chile, and Honduras all coming up by the end of the month. So we'll be visiting, hopefully, more cheerful elections over the course of the month.
Yeah, hopefully. Although Chile is worrying me, so maybe.
Even that probably won't be as depressing as this, as bad as that might be.
All right, so we'll leave it there. We'll see everyone next time. And yeah, please do rate and subscribe wherever you're listening. All right, goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. Bye.